Gail Walker. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Krista. How are you today?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Just wonderful.
And you are going to talk to us about native plants.
Yeah, I wanted to explain to everybody why there's such an emphasis on native plants nowadays.
What is a native plant? We'll start with that.
Sure. A native plant is one that has been here for hundreds or thousands of years. And it's, as a contrast to that, is non-native or also called alien plants that have been brought from somewhere else in the globe. It's much more than what we think of as just wild flowers. These are plants that have been adapted to our gardens, and they're common plants that you will see in lots and lots of gardens. So some examples of that would be purple coneflowers, black-eyed Susan, bee balm, columbine, false indigo, a lot of violets, asters, cardinal flower, goldenrod, native honeysuckles, sneezeweed, sunflowers, and I could go on and on. So there's lots and lots of native plants that you'll already find in home gardens.
Lots of familiar names there, that's for sure. And so why are native plants so important?
Well, to answer that question, we need to look at the food chain. So if you think of the classic picture where the little fish gets eaten by the bigger fish that gets eaten by the bigger fish, that's what I'm talking about by food chain. And all food chains start with plants because they're pretty magical in as much as they're the only living organism that can make their own energy. They take water, nutrients from the soil, and energy from the sun to create their own energy through a process called photosynthesis that we all studied back in science class.
Mm-hmm.
Then you take the factor with plants is that unlike animals, they can't move away from any predators. So they have to defend themselves from being eaten by a number of different techniques. They develop bad tastes or smells, or they develop toxins that the insects can't eat or they don't like. So native plant-eating insects and other herbivores, plant-eating things, evolved alongside our native plants and either developed a tolerance or a particular taste for a certain plant. So I'll give you a human example. I love sweet peppers. I'll put them in stir fries. I'll eat them raw in salads. I can eat them all the time. But I can't eat a dish that's made with those really hot Scotch bonnet peppers because I didn't grow up eating those.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like them. I don't want them. I'm going to leave them alone.
Mm-hmm.
People from other cultures think those are wonderful foods and can eat them all day long.
Yes, for sure. And I don't like Scotch bonnet peppers either.
So the adaptation by the insects to new plants can take a really, really long time. There have been some scientific studies done that show a plant like wild clematis, which comes from Europe, can support 40 species in Europe, but only one in North America, and that's 100 years after its introduction. Another example would be common reed, or Phragmites australis, is also called, and it supports 170 species of insects in the Middle East, but only 5 in North America, and that's 300 years after it was introduced. The end result of all of this is we have reduced the number of native plants in total that we grow in Canada and in North America. And then when we did that, we accidentally reduced the food available to the native food chain. So we have caterpillars that will eat our plants, eat the leaves. And a chickadee, a little tiny chickadee, needs 6,000 to 9,000 caterpillars to provide the protein needs for a single nest of fledglings. We can look at this decline of native plants to trace our declining bird population.
So interesting. And do you have an example of how an insect needs a specific native plant?
Sure, I've got two for you. One's a pretty common example that we know about, and that's the monarch butterfly. And the monarch butterfly can feed off many different plants, but when they're ready to lay their egg, they will pollinate a milkweed plant, and then they will lay their eggs on that plant. And they do that because it is the only plant that those caterpillars can eat. If they lay them on a different plant, the caterpillars die. If you break open a milkweed, it's got a milky white sap, that can actually cause a reaction to your skin. And it has a toxin in it, but caterpillars developed a tolerance for the toxin. And they even accumulate that in their bodies, which makes monarchs poisonous to would-be predators of the butterfly.
Hmm.
And then the second example is for a yucca plant, which is also known as Adam's needle. And these are really stunning plants that look a bit like a cactus. They've got very spiky leaves. And around about August, they'll throw up an absolutely spectacular white flower stalk. And they depend upon something called a yucca moth, which is a small whitish moth. And the moth will pollinate the yuccas to make sure that they continue to have the food of the yuccas available to them. And they lay their eggs inside the seed pods. The caterpillars eat those eggs and then eventually crawl out of the pod and pupate into moths. The yucca needs them for pollination and they need the yucca. And again, they can't eat any other plant.
And so, how did alien plants get here?
Good question. Some were imported by settlers to Canada that brought them as a memory of their homeland. And if you look around the county, lilacs and orange lilies are great examples of that. We think of them as, you know, they've always been here, but they haven't. They've only been here as long as the settlers were here. And a lot of other alien plants are introduced by the horticultural trade. We always want something new and novel for our garden. We look for solutions to diseases or pest problems, which is great. But because they're pest-free, it means their leaves won't be eaten by the insects, and the insects have nothing to eat.
Should we stop using all non-native plants?
No, I'm not going to suggest that you need to rip out your favorite irises, but I think we do need to get back to a healthy mix. To the ultimate target would be to get to 70% native and 30% non-native. So we would have a really solid backbone in our garden of the native plants, and then we can still have our favorites or our novelty items to be conversation pieces in the garden. And at that level of 70% native and 30% non-native or alien, we are at a position where the insect populations can sustain themselves.
And are there some non-native plants that we should not grow in our gardens?
Yes, there absolutely are. And those are the invasive plants. A lot of the alien plants without any natural disease inhibitors or insect enemies just reproduce with absolute enthusiasm and they crowd out native plants. So I'm going to ask all of the listening gardeners to please don't buy any invasive plants. Because you'll have lots of them in your garden, don't give them to your friends either. That only adds to the problem. I'll give you three examples of common invasive plants. Feather reed grass, also known as miscanthus. A very fast-growing species of grass is about 6 feet tall. We see it alongside the 401. It was planted a number of years ago, and it now just goes on for kilometers and kilometers. And it forms really thick, dense bunches, and it completely displaces the natural plant communities. We used to see bulrushes beside the highway. We don't see them. The second one is that common orange daylily we see everywhere. And those are, I grew up calling them tiger lilies. Other people call them ditch lilies. They are just absolutely everywhere. Come July, you'll see them lining the roads.
Mm-hmm.
And they form absolutely dense clumps, again, strangling out all the other vegetation around them. And the third one is periwinkle, or vinca minor. And it's a low-growing green ground cover with very pretty purple flowers on it in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
It spreads via shallow roots or stolons, and it crowds out the native ground covers.
Again, it's a very pretty plant, though.
It is a very pretty plant, and you'll see them in a lot of people's gardens.
I assume that invasive plants are not sold at nurseries.
Sadly, that is not true.
Oh.
And that's some of the ones I just mentioned you could go into a nursery and find. But there is a group that has formed that is advocating for the government to start banning many alien invasive species and for the government to do much more robust testing of new plants before they're allowed to be introduced into Ontario. Having invasive plants at the nursery just creates an absolutely vicious cycle. Gardeners look at things in the nursery and they might see Lily of the Valley there. Right. And they assume that those are safe for the environment because they're available for sale. But the nurseries don't stop selling them because they think they need to continue to supply them because the public is demanding them. And that's what we have to stop.
So how can I know if a plant is invasive?
Here's the easiest thing to think about. When you go to the nursery and you're looking at something and you think, well, that'd be perfect for my garden, pull out your phone, put in to Google the plant's name and the word invasive. If it is invasive, you'll get a pop-up that indicates that. And if that's the case, put it back and go and ask the nursery staff to recommend an alternative plant that has the same characteristics that you were drawn to, but is not an invasive plant. Second thing, listeners are encouraged to Google Grow Me Instead, and that will take them to an excellent booklet that has been developed for Ontario gardeners that lists a number of the common invasive plants and makes very good suggestions for what you should consider as an alternative to that. So that's Grow Me Instead.
Grow Me Instead and Google.
Yeah,
should be
absolutely
two easy things to remember.
I'm also going to recommend for anybody who's really interested in the subject an excellent book by Douglas Ptolemy, T-A-L-L-A-M-Y, and he wrote a book called Bringing Nature Home. And in that book, he describes how he took a semi-rural property and planted a lot of native species there and was able to reattract native insects and then ultimately native birds to his garden because he had made such a drastic change.
And how can I add more native plants to my garden?
That is an excellent question. And in 2 weeks, my colleague, Master Gardener Susan Warwick, is going to be coming on the air to talk about exactly how to convert your garden to more native plants. So she'll be able to give lots and lots of examples. But I'm going to leave your listeners with one very simple idea to do this year, and that is to reduce a bit of their lawn area and plant a native shrub. Mm. And if they did that every year, we'd be making huge progress.
Just one native plant a year.
Yeah, I mean, you can do more, but yeah. If you could just take up a little bit of lawn every year and put in that shrub, then you will be getting rid of lawn, which feeds absolutely nothing, and takes a lot of maintenance. And you can put in a beautiful plant that will feed the birds, the bees, the insects, and make the whole environment much better.
Do you have a suggestion for my first plant?
Well, my first suggestion is actually a willow tree, and those are fast growing, come into bloom quite early, so they're a great help for pollinators.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today, Gail.
You're most welcome, Krista, and I'll remind anyone who is looking for advice on a specific garden challenge, they're welcome to contact the Prince Edward County Master Gardeners via email, and our email is pecmastergardeners@gmail.com or through our website at pecmastergardeners.ca or our Facebook page, and we'd be happy to answer questions.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I'm Krista Hepburn. I've been speaking with Gail Walker, Master Gardener on County Grows.
Thanks for that, Gail and Krista.